21. I step closer to the massive burial mound, which probably contains a tall man who convinced the locals he was a god, which still happens in the modern world. My father told me stories about the Indian burial ground, about how the spirits of long-since dead natives walk the forest at night. I'm pretty sure the stories were intended to keep me from wandering off in the woods alone. Maybe I'll ask him. It wouldn't be a stretch to think that Enola's parents and grandparents conjured similar tales to keep their children out of the endless forest. But Enola is no child. Best guess she's over 30. While her tan face is free of wrinkles, there are a few strands of gray on her head, betraying her age. That she thinks a god's remains lies in the dirt means the Cherokee Nation as a whole believes the legend of this site. If you ask me, it's just a mound of dirt covered in grass. That it's missing in my time is a bit odd, but its presence here is just another story. Over the years, Adele has seen its fair share of tall tales, though I am coming to realize that most of them are true, and few of them were exaggerations. The mountain really has seen its fair share of historical drama, a good portion of which we've managed to whisk away into the past. Layers of history coexist on this mountain now, and eventually I fear it's going to get a little overcrowded. I hadn't noticed before, but the forest is absolutely brimming with bird songs. Some I don't recognize. They must be from species that went extinct before the 1980s. Where there was an occasional call in my time, there is now a chorus of chirps, as generations of birds gather together and enjoy the sudden spring. How many other populations are growing with each jump? How many predators? How many people? We've come across a lot of people already. Could there be more? Will they be dangerous like Chafin and Boone, or kind like my father and, I think, Enola? When I peel my eyes away from the burial mound and turn to Enola, I notice her arm is covered in streaks of blood. Seems the cat managed to cut her as well. You're hurt. She looks at the scratch and shrugs. That needs to be cleaned and dressed, my father says, reaching out for her arm. She yanks her arm out of reach, tensing. My father raises his open hands. I only mean to help. It could get infected. He turns to Owen. The first aid kit? I still remember where we kept the kit, in my right-hand cargo pants pocket. We carried it with us every time we ventured into the woods, but never had a reason to use it until now. Owen produces the kit and hands it to my father, who pops open the plastic container, revealing sterile bandages, band-aids, antibiotic ointment, and a few other tidbits. None of which make a lick of sense to Enola. She looks from the kit to my father and then to Owen and me. Where are you from? She motions to Boone, who is wandering the field, maybe looking for tracks, but who shows no sign of running. Him, I understand. You three. Even your clothing is strange. It's hard to explain, my father says, and I think he's actually going to try explaining the concept of time travel to an ancient Cherokee woman. We are from a faraway place, a more advanced place, technologically speaking. Look. He cracks open the package and pulls out a roll of gauze. It's bandage. She doesn't look convinced. I only want to help, my father says, and something about the way he says it, the earnest look of his eyes, I think, puts her at ease and brings a smile to her face. And in return? She asks, still suspicious. It's the question of a woman whose life hinges on bartering. Or at least it did. Now she'll be forced to move westward on a journey she might not survive. How about your friendship? My father says. Enola almost winces at the suggestion. Perhaps because we're strangers in the woods, or because we're all white men, or simply because it's a strange request in any time. But she once again finds comfort in my father's eyes, which makes my father happy in a way I've never seen. When I see Owen's confused expression, I know it's not something he's ever seen either. I have no idea if my father dated or even fancied a woman after my mother's death. I was a kid, so the subject never really crossed my mind. But he never brought anyone home to meet me, and I never seemed to pay any particular attention to women at church, the one place we mutually socialized. But there is no doubt about it, my father is attracted to Enola, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. There's a part of me that's always pictured him as a hopeless romantic, married to the memory of my mother, who at this point in his life has been dead for 11 years. I don't feel any real loyalty to my mother. I never knew her. I just hadn't considered that my father might be lonely. Then again, I'm his age and single too, so there's that. Maybe what I'm feeling is jealousy. Enola lifts her arm toward my father, agreeing to his offer of medical treatment. My father takes a small bottle of alcohol from the kit and unscrews the cap. This will clean the wound, but it will hurt a little. If it hurts a lot, you will share the pain. My father's smile is wry. Wouldn't have it any other way. And now he's flirting. I'm out, and so is Owen. We step away together, hands in our pockets. After a few steps, we stop in front of the burial mound and look at each other. He raises an eyebrow, and I match the expression. He wiggles both of his ears, and I do the same. I remember practicing these things in the mirror. Flaring nostrils come next. Easy, I say, and flex my nose. You're not like most adults, he says. I'm not sure that's true, but I say, okay. I mean, you're old, like really old, but you're nice. How do you mean? I ask. He's seen my violent side on full display. Like Pa. Like Pa. Your Pa. He rolls his eyes. Hold on a second. What? You know what? I've never pictured having a conversation with myself, but I'm not really surprised with how it's going. We might not be thinking the same thing, but we're on a similar wavelength, like twins separated by 34 years. He's missing a lot of what I've gained over the years, and I've forgotten most of what's still fresh for him, but somewhere in the middle, we're the same person. When did you figure it out? I ask. Well, it wasn't your good looks, he says and chuckles. What happened to us? I don't remember being a witty kid. I do remember trying to make people laugh and failing. Conservative churchgoers in Appalachia aren't well known for their senses of humor. I suppose we have the same sense of humor, though. You still kind of look like me, he says more seriously. And there's this. He points to the scar beside his eye, received when I tripped into the corner of a table. And this. He points to a scar above his eyebrow, delivered by a German shepherd who decided to eat my cheeseburger at a church barbecue and then my face. It's a unique set of scars. Wasn't until I saw the photo of you and Grandpa that I was sure, though. Think Dad knows? Owen shrugs. Didn't say anything about it, but why would he? Even you've been trying to hide it, not sure why. Back to the future, I say. He nods. Paradox, right. Well, too late for that. I mean, you and your friends killed some people that weren't supposed to die today, right? We saw the bodies. When I say nothing, he asks, where did you learn that anyway? You become a Marine Raider, Special Forces. His eyebrows rise. Like Megaforce? The good guys always win, I say, quoting the movie. Even in the 80s, he finishes, and we have a good laugh. It's official. I like me. But we didn't have flying motorcycles or gold spandex suits. Too bad, he says, and we stand there side by side for a moment, looking at the massive gravesite. I think he's probably picturing himself as a futuristic soldier, but he catches me off guard by asking, why wasn't Dad in the photo? I'm frozen for a second. How can I tell myself that my father is supposed to die tomorrow? I can't, is the answer. He took the photo. Huh, is his noncommittal response. I'm not sure if he believes me or not, but I get the sense he also doesn't want to hear the truth. I'm glad when he moves on. So your fake name, I wasn't very smart using Cass's last name. Suppose not. So what about her? Does that mean you're still, we're still? Friends? Yeah. Just friends? My young self catches me off guard again. Yeah? Too bad. Did I have a crush on Cassie? I've had so much history with her that it all just kind of blends together. What he doesn't know and what I can't explain is that after Dad died, I had trouble getting close to anyone. The pain of death changed me. This time tomorrow, he'll be just like me. Maybe. Things just didn't work out that way. I like you a little less, he says with a grin. I suppose she's married to some fellow we don't like and has kids of her own? Actually, no, she's here with me. She came back in time with you? And you don't... You haven't... He rolls his eyes and shakes his head. Didn't work out. Wait, she's the one we're looking for. Who's in danger? The kid's feathers are ruffled. All traces of apprehension are swept away. However strong my feelings are for Cassie, 11-year-old me wore them a lot closer to a sleeve. We spend the next 10 minutes waiting for Dad to finish and talking about Owen's life and mine. I avoid the details of how things happen, just in case, and he tells me about things I had forgotten. Each story chips away at old memories and feelings, long since walled away. I nearly cry a few times, but hold it in because he'd no doubt sense I'm holding out on some painful information. Hey, Boone says, crouching by the clearing's edge. What do you make of this? He waits for Owen and me to approach, then he raps his knuckles on the ground. Instead of a dull thud, there is a hollow metallic gong. I crouch and slide my hand across the smooth surface of a metal pipe that should not exist in this ground, let alone in this time. Given the subtlety of its arc and the resounding nature of the sound, I guess it's close to 8 feet in diameter. This is from the future, Boone says, eyes a little wild. Ain't it? Reckon it is, I say, but I didn't know it was here.
Me neither,
Owen says. Our house is less than a mile south from here. I gauge the pipe's direction and turn my head toward Adele, laying down an imaginary track. If it continues straight, it would work its way up, straight toward Synergy. What'd you find? My father asks, walking over with a patched-up Enola by his side. She looks as confounded by her discovery as I am. I give the pipe a knock and know my father will understand it. Runs toward the peak. Toward the mine, he says. If it's from my time, I say, and it looks like it is, the metal is free of rust or corrosion. Then it's not the mine it leads to.
Your time? Enola says. What are you?
Before she can finish the question, the answer comes rolling down the hill. Owen manages to ask, Already? Before the flux hits. Now that I'm ready for it, the nausea caused by the wave of sound and distortion transplanting me through time is less severe. My father and Owen handle it fairly well, too. Boone is laid out again, writhing and cursing. Enola falls to her knees, eyes closed, body trembling. She's feeling every bit as horrible as Boone, but is managing it far better. My father crouches beside her, a gentle hand on her back. It will pass. And then it does. The flux rushes beyond our sight, leaving a lush green summertime downpour in its wake. Lightning cuts through the sky above. The boom of thunder makes Boone squeal in fright. Before I can fully take stock of our situation, Owen tugs on my arm the same way he does to my father. When I look down at him, he motions his head toward the far side of the field, where the burial mound is. Where the burial mound was.